to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Susan, and hello to all our listeners out there. I know we have a very special guest today who will make this a very unusual program.
Yes, it is my pleasure to welcome Stefan Schmidt, Dr. Politics, to many who listen to his weekly programs on WOI. Thanks for coming over from your farm near Nevada to be with us today and for agreeing to tell our listeners about your online course at iowacaucusmooc.org.
Well, it's my pleasure always, and I love this station. Of course, you are doing just a fabulous job, and I don't know how we lived without KHOI, so it's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. I was thinking about the irony of this interview, because I've been listening to some of your other interviews, and most recently I guess you had one on Fox News, right?
I get interviewed by, you know, anyone who's got electricity, especially with the Iowa caucuses building up. There's more interest than I've ever seen in my 45 years. And yes, Neil Cavuto called me and wanted to know why so many Iowans don't go to the caucuses and what the parties are doing about it. And that was a fun interview. But I also do a lot of progressive interviews with Arnie Arneson in Concord, New Hampshire. And, you know, across the range, I do a lot of international stuff now, just a huge amount. The Dutch television is sending a team. They're doing a documentary on Iowa and the Iowa caucuses, and they're going to be here just before the caucuses, and we're going to try to get together and spin a little bit of Iowa and especially Pella and the Dutch tradition in Iowa. So it's just been a marvelous year. And the dynamic this year, the candidates, their character, and the issues has just set everything on fire. That's good for me because I love doing this. It may not be so good for the country.
This is a very unusual caucus year. And I think somewhere in your course you said every caucus has its own story.
Well, that's true. You know, every caucus is the child of the times. And so if you go back to 1972, when kind of the first modern presidential caucuses took place, it was the Vietnam War, it was McGovern, it was the Democratic Party run by bosses that essentially set the tone in those early years. And in 2016, well, we know, you know, what is driving the caucuses. It is partly what's happening in the United States, but it's also certainly events way beyond our borders that sneak up on us and surprise us, and, you know, including the Iranians suddenly seizing an American boat 3 hours before the president gives his State of the Union address. So the caucuses are always subject to surprises, and I think that makes them very interesting.
Yes. We had someone on earlier this month who said that people actually do change their minds at the caucuses, and that this makes the polling impossible, because they may have told the pollster, I'm going to be for whoever, and then they go and they are convinced that they really would rather be for somebody else.
Well, and you hit it right on the head. I mean, the nail has been driven in, because I told Neil Cavuto that. He said, you know, what happens at the caucuses? Why are the polls often so wrong? And it's exactly what I said. The caucuses are not a primary. In primary states, people make up their mind, and then on the morning of the primary election, they go to their polling place and vote at 7 in the morning or at noon or before it closes. And they really don't talk to that many people before they pull that lever or mark that ballot. In Iowa, you go to your precinct, 1,700 of those more or less, and there you are with neighbors and friends and other people, and they say, well, Stefan, who are you going to support this year in the caucus? And you say, blah, 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 you know, Donald Trump or whatever. And they say, oh, you can't do that. You know, he's not going to win or she's not going to win. And then you have actually somewhat of a conversation before you decide how you're going to vote at the caucus. And a lot of people's minds actually are changed because of those conversations. And I think that's a wonderful thing. It's more reflective. There's a lot more thought that goes into it because you talk about it just before you finally make that important decision.
It's more like a New England town meeting where people come together and talk, and you can be frank and honest with each other and actually even try to motivate or change opinion. So it's the ultimate political activism at the grassroots level, although there are plenty of people who think we're flyover territory, who, in fact, there was a television series this week that really put down the Iowa caucuses, and there were a lot of comments by the characters about how recalcitrant and provincial Iowa was and how it shouldn't be the bellwether of the country. So we're always dealing with that feedback, too, you know.
The caucuses are always subject to all kinds of snarky criticism, especially by those who are jealous of the fact that we have them. I always tell them when they say that, per capita, more Iowans have passports than people in any other of the 50 states.
That's good news.
And why is that? Not because they're going to, you know, go to Story City, not because they're going to drive up to Minnesota. It's because Iowans are, in fact, very cosmopolitan, very world-oriented. They travel, they go as missionaries, they go as tourists or working on all kinds of volunteer projects. And in business, Iowa is an enormous global economic power. Most of what we do in Iowa is a market of, in the world, including our agricultural products.
And we have the highest graduation from high school rate in the country.
We still have that,
yes. And then we see that Des Moines is the number one place for young professionals to begin their careers and have a lifestyle that's commensurate with their desires. So it kind of belies the idea that this is a provincial place where people are backward.
Absolutely. And we even have Starbucks.
Right, we have Starbucks. And then maid rights. Well, you see, this is what these foreign reporters have to really try, is the maid right.
Maid right, exactly. We need to take them to Marshalltown.
Oh, isn't that a great maid right?
Yeah.
Taylor's?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Well, you, Stephen, have a course you're teaching, and Susan is one of your students.
My goodness,
online.
Is that right?
Yes, I am.
I know, I've seen your name in there.
You might tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what we just talked about, which is the misunderstanding of the Iowa caucuses, drove me to talk with several people, including Vice President John Wickard and others. And I said, you know, we really should launch a free course on the Iowa caucuses and make it interesting. And I'll do some interviews with people who have interesting stories to tell about the caucuses. We'll make it not for credit, and people can sign in and they can just roam around. They don't have to start and finish it. You know, if they don't have a lot of time, they can just sign in and look at a few things and post one or two discussions if they want. So it's not very high pressure. And the international news media in particular, they call me all the time. They say, you know, what are the Iowa caucuses? Well, now I tell them, well, first of all, go sign into my Iowa caucuses, MOOC. You can Google that. That's easy to do. It's Iowa caucuses. MOOC, which means Massive Open Online Course. There are other open, massive open online courses, but it's massive because, I mean, I don't know how many are in at this point, but we've had 2,000, 2,500, maybe 3,000 people from around the world sign into this thing. This is the fourth rollout of it. And the last one, it ends just before the actual caucuses.
And so the course structure includes the history of the Iowa caucuses and looking back at some of the major campaigns and impacts the caucuses have had.
It does. It goes back and tries to make the case that, you know, Iowa is first in the nation because we decided to pick up on the McGovern-Frazier reforms, which came out of the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, which was a huge disaster with protesters and the police and Mayor Daley. And the Democratic Party decided we need to improve the participation rate of people to join our party, including women and minorities and others. So
the death of the smoke-filled room.
That's right. Yeah. And the death of the smoke-filled room, which meant sort of party bosses, right. Smoking cigars, in some dark room somewhere deciding who's going to be the candidate for president and then kind of wiring the whole thing. That just seemed outdated. And so the caucus reforms were launched. And I should probably immediately tell the story of why Iowa was first in the nation. It was simply because the process was complicated. You had to have the 1,700 precincts where you held the caucus. You had to write up the report and send it on in time for the county conventions to hold their 99 county conventions. And then the county conventions had to fill out reports and send them on to the district conventions, which are conventions by the parties in the congressional districts. And then the districts had to send that information of, you know, platform positions and leadership and so on for finally the state convention. And the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party was from Ames, said, well, how are we going to do this? Because we're going to have to reproduce all these documents from 1,700 precincts and then move them on in time for the next one. And in those days, all they had was mimeograph machines. You know, mm-hmm. Your listeners will know what they are. My students have never heard of this. You had to type it on a typewriter onto a stencil, and then you had to put it into a machine and pour in some nasty liquid. And then you had to crank it, usually by hand, and get those reports out.
I did that in the Army. I typed up orders.
Sure.
I'm very familiar with that. And it was it was laborious, and you had to be pretty good.
Yeah.
Because if you made a typing error, you had to put some kind of goop on the stencil
to
fix it.
Or type it all over again from scratch.
Oh, yes. It was really difficult.
And so my obviously, in 1970, when I came to Iowa State, my course syllabi that I handed out, they were done on stencils.
Right.
And so the Democratic Party said, well, if we're going to be timely and get the reports from the precinct caucuses out in time for everybody else, we're going to have to do this early in January because it's going to take a long time. And so Iowa said, well, we're going to have our presidential caucus every 4 years and our regular caucuses in January. Well, it turns out that that was earlier than any of the other 50 states. And it's only because they made that decision, Cliff Larson and some of the others who were involved, that Iowa ended up doing this before any other states. And that was terrific because it was nice and early, and it was an indicator of how the Democrats felt about candidates. And so the news media became interested. And, of course, when Jimmy Carter won the caucuses in 76, it was huge because nobody knew who Jimmy Carter was. And the media really got excited. And that's how the story unfolded. And then it became a tradition.
And then, coincidentally, the Republicans became involved in the same process. Is that correct?
The Democrats and Republicans in Iowa in those days liked each other, worked closely with each other, and they said, well, we have caucuses in the Republican Party, too. They're different from the Democrats. We're not as feely-touchy, and we don't, you know, do all the division and the viability and all these complicated things. But we don't want the news media to come to the Democratic caucus and report and then go back and then have to fly back to Iowa and do the Republican. So why don't we do these on the same night just for the convenience of the media? And that was a great decision. And the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee said, you know, we're going to keep Iowa first. And then New Hampshire said, well, we have primaries here and we'd like to be in this. And so they said, well, okay, you can be the first primary in the country. So we have two firsts, Iowa presidential caucuses, and a week later, the New Hampshire presidential primary. And I've always argued with the news media, and especially with The Daily Show, which interviewed me and did a very snarky little, humorous thing on Iowa, in which they trashed Iowa as usual. I said, look, you know, it's a tradition. It's very nice. After Iowa and New Hampshire, the candidates go on, and then pretty soon it gets huge and you have to have a lot of money. But in Iowa and New Hampshire, you don't have to have a lot of money to try and launch your campaign. That was in those days. Nowadays, it's become very expensive. But so it's a nice tradition, and I think it has done its work. And I'll tell you why I think it's done its work. It's because since 1972, no candidate of either party who came in fourth in Iowa made it to become the candidate of their party.
That's true. And I think, as Darwin says, everything evolves from something. And look at the simple origins of this and how it's become part of the American political scene. And I really think the other thing that we always talk about is the tremendous hands-on work you have to do as a candidate and going to small coffee shops and meeting people. That is really bringing the candidate down to tangibility for the average person. Everyone can touch, feel, and shake hands with a candidate who may become president. So that's unique in Iowa, and also, I think, to some extent, probably in New Hampshire. And that really personalizes it and makes the candidate work to get out the vote, just as if he were a local alderman.
That's right. I agree. Well, it's been pointed out here that in 2008, John McCain was not third, but he was third in the sense that he was tied for third place with Fred Thompson. So, you know, I mean, he wasn't fourth. He was tied with Fred Thompson, so there were two candidates who were in third place. So the theory holds, the ship isn't sinking, the truth has been told. Because I know the news media always say, well, what about John McCain? Now, John McCain had 13%, Fred Thompson had 13%. They were both in second place. And so Iowa has done a very good job, not of selecting the candidate for president, but of very smart people in both parties saying, we like this person, and this person, and we think people in New Hampshire may like one of those as well, and then others in South Carolina or on Super Tuesday may agree with us. And they have always agreed on one of the three, you know, one, two, three.
Well, if you're a party leadership in either party, you get to see who has campaign skills from watching the activities of the caucus. You know, who's personable, who meets people well, who handles stress, and how effective are they one-on-one. So it's really a dress rehearsal in so many ways.
It is a dress rehearsal. And those who, I sometimes say to, I said to the German news service, which also talked to me the other day, that it's really kind of like off-Broadway where you launch a play and you see how it connects with the audience, and then you tweak it and fix it, and then maybe you'll be on Broadway. And these people come here, and they tweak their message and their campaign style, and they remove exclamation marks from their name because those are annoying. They find that out from Iowa voters. And then maybe they go on. I don't know if Jeb Bush with the exclamation mark is going to make it, but Lamar Alexander did not remove the exclamation mark when he was running, and he kept wearing that checkered red and black shirt, which turned out to turn people off, and he faded away. So Iowa is a great test market. You know, Des Moines is one of the great test markets for products. For example, Jell-O. Apparently, you know, when they want to launch a new flavor of Jell-O, they go to Des Moines and they give it to a bunch of people. And if they don't like it, then they say, well, this isn't going to fly. So
that's right. Iowa is a real center for call centers for all kinds of businesses and industries because we have a more neutral accent.
That's true.
If you have a complaint about a product, you really want to talk to a guy from the Bronx saying, hey, forget it.
Forget about
it. You bought it. It's your problem.
That's right. Yeah.
But I think the main thing here is that we're right in the midst of this. It's a great time. Hotel rooms are going for $900 in Des Moines.
Amazing.
And we're at the center of attention. And I think everybody has, like they always say, everybody has a story. And I think Susan has done a good job of rounding up some people who have some stories, and she's compiled some of these.
I want to hear those.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, you'll recognize the probably recognize
fabulous.
Some of the storytellers.
Wonderful.
And but actually, the first story is a Republican story, and this is I do have a question. The reforms. The proportionate representation is the most important one.
Sure.
That was not carried over to the Republican Party, right?
No, the Republican Party decided to have their caucuses, but to instead have it very simple. They were not that excited or interested in having diversity or, you know, things like that. And so they said, come to the caucus at 7 o'clock. You can have a little conversation before the vote, talk with your neighbors, and people can say, well, would you support my candidate because she or he is really good? But then they vote right away, and they vote in the secret ballot, and that's it. In the Democratic Party, as you said, you have to have something like 15% of the people in each precinct supporting a certain candidate or you don't become viable. So it's the viability issue. And if you have 15%, then people can vote for your candidate, and that is all reported. But if you don't, if your candidate has less, for example, O'Malley probably isn't going to have 15% this time around in most of the precincts. O'Malley supporters will have to either decide Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, or just say undecided, because you have to have 15% in order for your candidate to be considered viable in an Iowa precinct.
And in the Democratic caucus, you stand in groups.
And you stand physically in groups.
Yeah, you're really talking about showing your preference openly.
Yeah,
it's not a secret ballot.
No, that's
exactly
absolutely
the
right.
Reverse.
Yes,
know?
It is exactly right. And that's why, in a way, it's so honest, because, you know, you say, I support Bernie Sanders, I support Hillary Clinton, I support O'Malley, and you stand in that corner, and people know, and you're not embarrassed, you know, that you chose that. And it also reduces sort of maliciousness, you know. If it's a secret ballot, you can write down Mickey Mouse or, you know, somebody else. In the Democratic caucuses, Mickey Mouse never wins.
No. That's true.
And I bet he doesn't ever win in a Republican caucus. We are very fortunate today to have Norm Rudy with us, who was county chair, Republican county chair in are you there, Norm?
Yes, I am here.
So, well, thank you for being with us. And this was 84, is that correct?
I was county chair from 1980 until 1985.
Mm. And actually, the story that you told me yesterday raises another issue. We were talking about how the caucus has developed to become more democratic and so forth. And why don't you tell your story, and then we can see if there's an issue there.
Well, I might preface it by saying that back then, in 1980-1984, we had maybe two candidates or three candidates, and not 15 like we have today. But at that time, there was an effort by religious groups to get involved in politics and try to take over the party. And the big issue at the time was pro-life, pro-choice, which I found to be quite divisive and very contentious. And people talk at each other, but they never change any minds. It's just a constant argument. And so in 1984, as I was running the county convention, my opening statement, I said that getting involved in that particular argument was very contentious, and that I would make a motion that we not even bring it up during the session, that we just avoid it altogether so that we could concentrate on things that we felt were important in politics. And the group agreed. They took a vote, and although it wasn't unanimous, they said, okay, we will not bring this up. And we had a very, very spirited convention discussing other things, and that 5 o'clock at night, I felt that we had to wrap things up, and I indicated that a lot of us had commitments and were going to leave. And at that point, three or four people, or I guess maybe it was more than that, maybe 10 or 12 people indicated that they had a couple other things they wanted to discuss and would continue. And so those who were the moderates, those who were the liberals, those who were Republicans, left. And the 10 or 12 who were left, who remained, ended up having an election, elected a new chair for the remainder of the convention, and then passed 8 or 9 planks dealing with pro-life, pro-choice, and that didn't even make any sense. But they were added to our platforms that were submitted to the district later on. But it was at that time that I really feel that those who had a strong religious leaning attempted to take over the party. And I think it's been consistent ever since.
Did those planks make it all the way to the state platform?
A lot of them were weeded out before it got to the state platform. But the state platform at that time did contain one or two planks that dealt with it.
Well, Norm, this is Paul Wearson, co-host. I think the moral of that story is don't leave the caucus early. So make sure everyone's out the door at the same time.
Well, yeah, of course, this was the district meeting, but this is this raised to me was the danger of caucuses being hijacked. And back in 68, before they had the reforms, when the caucuses tended to have been run by the precinct chairs, there was a technique devised called packing the caucuses. And I think that's still, although they don't think they use the word anymore, that's still quite feasible. You just have enough people. You don't have that many people at a caucus. Even if you have a caucus of 100, you can easily get 50 extra people to come in with your view, which may be not a representative view of the population at large.
Well, I think at that particular time, the Democratic caucus and the Republican caucus were two different animals.
Hmm.
And I had a very close friend who taught at Iowa State University. He's still a close friend, although we throw so many barbs at each other that I'm surprised we're not bleeding constantly. we would meet and discuss what's going on, and it was like two different worlds. And I think that as the caucuses have developed over the years, they're more alike. I think you could change four words and not know if you were in a Republican caucus or Democratic caucus.
Not this year.
No, I think this is not the year.
Although there's some words that are quite surprising that come up in both of them, like revolution, which is a surprising...
It's also fashionable to be an outsider, you see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole gist of this is that what's happening in Washington isn't working, so if you are an outsider, then you're probably somebody who can fix it. Now, how many job openings do you have where the best resume is the one that has no experience on it?
Well, the Democrats certainly don't have any outsiders. You know, the Democrats are solid professional politicians.
That's right.
I mean, you can call Bernie Sanders an outsider just because he's a Democratic socialist, but he's been in politics ever since he was, you know, a little child bottle fed, I think, you know.
Oh, yes, and there's so much political theater out there.
Yeah.
The things you have to do to get the nomination from your party
yeah.
base are really a dramatic contrast to what you have to do when it comes to a general election.
That's right.
You know, so a good example, and I'm not singling her out, both parties do it, is Joni Ernst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during the race for the nomination, she was shooting guns and wearing leather and castrating hogs and, by extension, Democrats. And then when she became a nominee, a nice lady in a pink dress yeah. who cares about everybody.
Yeah.
So, and she's not the only one.
Yeah.
Both Republicans and Democrats do political theater.
Well, just a minute. We've still got... I think we still have John on the line. And I mean, I really appreciate your coming on, and we're not going to be able to solve the issues facing our parties this year, this morning. But there's a question I have that... I was told that they more recently had a problem with delegates not staying committed and that there was going to be a change in the rules in the Republican Party about that in Iowa. Is that true?
Hello, yes. If you're asking me, mm-hmm. I don't know that I can address that. I have backed... First of all, I'm one of those outsiders now.
Huh.
And as I look at the makeup of the party, there are such diverse views, and there are so many people with aspirations that it's just shooting off in all directions. And it's like, as you pointed out with Joni Ernst, once she got elected, she was a different animal.
Mm-hmm.
She was a different person. And I think right now the object is to be noticed and to get attention. And then what happens beyond that, we'll find out what their true colors are. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's the way I perceive the situation in the Republican Party right now. There are so many wannabes, and there are those who are espousing viewpoints that are diametrically opposed to the Constitution, and still they beat their chests and proclaim it very loudly, and they're not going to change the Constitution, no matter how hard they try. That I think the constitutionalists will prevail.
It's a very interesting process, and I'm a real history nut, so I do really feel that ultimately everybody finds out about everything in some way or another. So who you are eventually surfaces.
Well, it'll be an interesting month. So thank you very much for joining us today, Norm. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That was an interesting conversation, and he sounds like a nice, level-headed guy, and he's my kind of Republican or Democrat who's a realist, you know. Here's the world as it presents itself, and we have to, at some point, weed out the political theater and say, this is real, this is what works, this is what might really shine for our party in a general election, because you do have to appeal to your base to a certain extent, but you can't. I think recently and historically, the American electorate in a general election has been center-right. That means if you're too far left, you have to tack back. Mm-hmm. If you're too far right, you have to tack back. Yeah. Well, you know, that's difficult because the opposing party just plays the tape. And there you are saying something that was ridiculous.
That's true. And the last time a Republican got elected president, he was got elected because he was a compassionate Republican. Let's not forget that.
That's right.
And, you know, Mitt Romney...
they literally played the tape back on Mitt.
That's right. They literally played the tape back, and he was not very compassionate, and the 47% that he sort of trashed really turned off a lot of people. So we don't know how this is going to roll out in 2016, because certainly the Democrats have a very liberal front runner, or he's about to be the front runner in Iowa because he's mm-hmm. catching up with Hillary Clinton. And the Republicans have some very, very conservative people and people like Donald Trump who actually don't fit ideologically. He's not really a conservative. He is something else.
Well, how do these people tack back to the center, Stephanie?
Well, they
how do they do that?
They try, right? Yeah.
Well, we're not going to solve that this morning, and it is now time for our station breaks. This is radio station KHOI-FM 89.1, and your hosts, Paul Wearson and Susan Franzen, have Stefan Schmidt with us today discussing the online course on the Iowa caucuses that is available online right now under iowacaucusmooc.org, and that'll be on our website.
Yeah.
Norm Rudy has joined us to tell us about an experience he had as Story County Chair in 1984, which brings up a lot of interesting issues. And we'll continue our caucus stories by going back now to the first Democratic caucus after 1972 with Mary Ann Lundy, who was precinct chair right after the new rules were adopted. Mary Ann, are you with us?
I'm here this morning, and I'm going to tell you about an experience that I had in 2008, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was wrong about when it was.
It was the year that there were many, many candidates, before President Obama was elected. Mm. And at that time, it was Precinct 4-2. It's since been redistricted. But we had over 400 people in the Sawyer School gym. It was literally packed. I'm sure The fire marshal maybe wouldn't have been too happy if he'd have come by. But people were talking and talking about their candidates, and there were many that year. And I called the precinct to order with no PA system in that gym with 400 and some people, and I said in a very loud voice, I said, you are going to have no side conversations and listen very carefully, because there are more people in this gym today than in the hometown that I grew up in. And, you know, we got a big laugh, and people were very cooperative. But what surprised me was that the next day, my cousin in Seattle, Washington, called me to say that that code had appeared on the front page of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer paper. And he was calling to tell me that I'd made the front page there. And I said, oh, my goodness, that just means how much people come and how many media people come and attend and how much attention is really focused on Iowa at the time of the caucuses.
Wow, fascinating.
That is, and that's my caucus. And I remember that caucus was... Well, you said there were 400. The Obama supporters were all out in the hall because they couldn't all fit in the gym.
No,
that's right. It was a very it was not the best venue. We hope this year that the venues chosen are adequate. You know, I don't think a lot of times you still will have to deal without a PA system, but hopefully the venues have been chosen carefully this year and there will be room for people.
Do you think this year is going to be a big turnout?
You know, I really am anticipating that. It seems like there's been a lot of enthusiasm. I'm seeing more young people seeming to be engaged this year. I'm thinking it might be a big turnout.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's going to be a record turnout in both parties because the passions are running very high and the Democrats have an interesting, basically, choice to make. So,
I think the Democratic caucus will be far more interesting than we would have projected 6 months ago.
Absolutely
because
right.
Because of the rise of Sanders.
Absolutely right.
And then the Republicans have so many candidates by virtue of the number and the passion they're involved again, there should be a great turnout too. Yeah. So I think the news media people are probably wisely spending $900 a night to watch that.
And grumbling about it a lot, I'll bet.
I grumble about it too if I were the accountant over at CBS. What is this? You know, Iowa, $900 a month.
Well, they can stay in a motel in what cheer and drive to Des Moines then.
Yeah, the mom and pop motel. I think over at Nyland. Remember, Susan?
Nyland
Cafe.
Yeah.
They go to the Nyland Cafe and bring your typewriter. It's going to be real old fashioned.
Well, thank you, Marianne. That was a great story.
Well, thank you.
And now we have one from someone who probably is pretty well known to our listeners, who was involved. Now this one I do believe was the 72 caucus, and actually. But she says, relate back to your course, because in your course, you talked about the people who really, I think you call them the founders.
The founding fathers of the Iowa caucuses,
And they were Richard Bender and Richard Seagrave.
That's right. Okay. They were both Richards. One of them likes to be called Dick, the other not. Seagrave and Bender, they really did a job with the chair of the Democratic Party of Iowa. In creating that format for the first caucus, because they came up with all the mathematics of how you do the proportional representation, and Bender is a mathematician. He's a genius, which is why it's so complicated to figure out how all that math works.
Well, that story really leads into Mary Richard's story. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Susan.
A familiar voice on KHOI. We're so happy you're with us, and what happened with your first caucus?
Well, if you really want to go back to our first caucuses, it was when we lived out in Milford Township, just across the creek from where Stephen and Hoyt live, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
And when the caucuses would be in our front room, and there would be half a dozen, maybe eight people there, and our biggest problem was to find somebody who was willing to be on the platform committee for district and, you know, fill all the, it would call up people who were not there and say, can we put your name on? So it was very different from the one that Marianne described and the caucuses that I experienced after moving into Ames, that 400 people coming out of the gym, or I heard stories of caucuses that were held in people's homes where there would be people talking through the window because there was not any space for them inside. The one that you particularly want me to recount was the first time that that proportional representation formula was put into effect. And I'm telling you, people were so confused, and the people who were running it were reading the directions line by line, and it was just it was a picnic. It really was an amusing scene. I think everybody's gotten used to it by now, but that first time was just, it was really an experience.
Well, Mary, you're also a star in my Iowa caucuses MOOC, M-O-O-C, course, because we did a wonderful interview in your house with some of our neighbors from Milford Township and others, and I want people to make sure that they sign up for that course and watch that interview, because it was great.
Well, we had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, too. We did.
Well, actually, though, you also told me a Richard Bender story, and maybe you don't want to tell the first part of the Richard Bender story, which was your frustration with the people who came up with the person who came up with this system, and I don't know what you said about that person, but I said, oh yeah, that's Richard Bender. And then you told me another story about Richard Bender.
I did. Actually, I think it was that night that everyone felt extremely frustrated because they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
But once we got used to it and understood the logic and the advantages of having proportional representation, I think it's a much more fair system, even though it does take time and you have to learn it. The other story that I told you about Rich Bender was, of course, he was very instrumental in Tom Harkin's campaigns and was on Tom Harkin's staff for many years. He happened to be in the Story County, I don't know what we would call it, where we were all gathering after the election the first time I ran in 1978. And he was looking at the returns. He looked at the first, I think it was 3 or 4 precincts that came in, which, of course, were the very rural precincts where there were not people, and so they could, you know, they could count it quickly and call it in quickly. He looked at those, and he told me, he turned around and he said, "You've won." And I had lost each of those precincts, but he could tell I had won by the percentage of the vote. And he was right.
Wow.
He was absolutely really astounding. Whoever it was that said he was brilliant was right.
That would be me. And Mary, what were you running for?
I was running for county attorney.
Exactly. And you were one of our students in the political science department at Iowa State, and then you went on to Drake University, and we loved having you in our department, I'll tell you that. We missed you when you graduated.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed my time there as well.
Well, thank you so much, Mary, for coming and sharing your stories. And we'll have to, we hope a lot of people will sign up for Stefan's class so that they can, you'd be on which week would you be on?
Oh, we just started and people can jump in there and hop around and catch up. You can spend just an hour in there or 10 minutes, but I want everyone to go Iowa Caucuses MOOC MOOC on Google and you'll hit it right away.
Incidentally, it's Iowa Caucus because I double checked that today.
Iowa Caucus. I always say caucuses because there are 1,700 of them.
And that's right.
The developers of the course wouldn't listen to me. Yes, nobody listens to me. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's a problem, right? Nobody listens to you.
No, we have
one more story with Dave Hoffman, who was at one of those very first caucuses, the ones in 68 that really where all the trouble started.
And by the way, caucuses have been held much forever. You know, the parties have had caucuses in every state in the country, usually only for party business. I mean, the presidential part of it started in 72 or 76, but the parties have caucuses in other states, but it's just for party business, platform issues, leadership, selecting, you know, party leaders. And so people should not think that we invented something called the caucuses because the parties have always had those. It's just that the presidential part of it became so huge with the 72 and 76. Yeah.
Well, I think we have Dave with us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. And when I called to find out if you had a story, I was amazed that it was such a choice one. So why don't you tell who you were or what you were doing in 1968 and what happened in your caucus?
Well, Judy and I came to Ames in at the start of the academic year in 67, and we had become quite interested in politics, particularly because of the Vietnam War, and I was involved with a group on campus at the time that was interested in pushing the anti-war issues. And when the caucuses rolled around, they were in the spring, April, I think, maybe?
Yes.
And so I lived up on the north side, just across the street from where North Grand is now. The mall wasn't there at the time. And I was involved in getting people to come to the caucus. In those days, they were held in people's homes. Yeah. And this one, was a fellow named Don Smith was the person who had our caucus up in the north end of town. And we got quite a few people, McCarthy people, to show up, and we sort of overwhelmed the place. I think that was taking place all over Ames of that particular caucus. And as it turned out, I got elected to be the precinct committeeman. We replaced all the traditional people in those positions. All the McCarthy people sort of overran the thing. I think I maybe got chosen because I'd been instrumental in getting a lot of folks to come, and so people knew who I was. And so at any rate, I had not intended to be elected to that position, but I was. Then later on, I should say we can sort of control everything at the in Ames, but as it went to the county and then to the state, we lost control. So I think Susan and I were talking about the state convention that year, and it definitely, the McCarthy people did not control that. But at any rate, as it turned out, we moved from the north up by North Ground over to the west side of Ames that year, and don't quite remember how it worked, but somehow I was responsible for finding a replacement for myself as precinct committeeman, and the people I knew from the caucuses, I couldn't get them involved, so I decided sort of in desperation, I guess, that I would just go out and knock on doors. So, and that's what I did. And as I remember, one of the first doors I knocked on was Dick Seagrave's house. I didn't know him at the time. And I asked him if he'd be interested, if he was a Democrat, and he'd be interested in being a precinct committeeman, sort of out of the blue. And he said, well, yes, I would. And that was his start of his rather stellar involvement in Democratic politics in Story County.
Well, that's a story that's never been told before. I mean, you were responsible for Seagrave kind of rising up there and then eventually becoming one of the founding fathers of the modern caucuses. That's just fabulous.
That's the way I remember it.
Wow.
Whether he remembers it the same way, I'm not quite sure. But it was a very strange thing because you know, it was out of desperation that I went out, and it was the chances of finding somebody by that particular method were remote.
But it shows the power of grassroots activism, doesn't it? I mean, that's what we're all about, is grassroots, getting involved, and one person can make a huge difference if they get involved. And that's my message to my students and others is, you know, get involved and go to the caucuses, and who knows, you might do some magic there.
Well, we were sure glad that Dick did it, because he was really an influential person in Democratic politics for years and years after that.
Well, it sounds like you were present at creation. And so
did you coin that phrase?
Well, I don't know. It sounds familiar.
He's used it before.
But I really think that's important, as Stefan said, because you never know who you tap on the shoulder who might become immortal.
True.
You know?
That's true.
That's right. And that's really interesting. It's also interesting what you said about the caucus locally that you were in, being so pro-McCarthy. Mm-hmm. And then when that was exposed to a wider audience, that changed somewhat. So each caucus...
Well, Susan will remember what it was like at the state convention.
Well, I wasn't at the state convention.
Oh, you were not there.
No, but I heard from a number of people who were that their mics were turned off.
Yeah, well, the powers that be were in control by that stage.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So the bosses were still in place.
Yeah, they were still there, but it wasn't just our precinct. Yeah. All over Ames. As I remember, it was a warm spring night, and there were places these caucuses were typically held in homes. Yep. And people were overflowing the homes and sitting out in lawns and all kinds of things. You know, there were just so many people involved. And
yeah, it was really a fantastic experience.
When I hear all this and all the descriptions and things that have happened, what comes to mind visually to me is Norman Rockwell's painting of the man who's rather shoddily clad, mm-hmm. standing amidst his fellow members in his community.
That's right.
Bravely giving a speech.
At the town hall meeting.
Well, it wasn't like that. I mean, these people hadn't cleaned up yet to be clean for Gene. I mean, you know, that was... Unfortunately, this is such a big topic, and we're at the end of our hour, and so I think we'll have to just come back to that another time. And yes, there's a lot of history there, and it certainly is... a lesson that if you go and you get involved, the chances you're making a difference are maybe slight, but it's somebody's going to do it.
Well, if you look at history, all the great movements, all the great achievements started with one person who did something.
Well, that's right, and that's where most of our leaders come from.
Right.
I tell my students, they say, how can I get involved in politics? I say, you know, work for a campaign, volunteer for something, get started, because you can't jump in at the top. You have to start at the bottom, and the caucuses are definitely a good place to do that.
And you've already qualified as a human being who lives in America.
That's right. That's exactly right.
This is Local Talk on KHI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been so fortunate to have Stefan Schmidt with us. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
From Nevada.
Yeah.
And we've also heard from Norm Rudy and Marianne Lundy and Mary Richards and Dave Hoffman with stories of caucuses and, in Norm Rudy's case, a state convention. Your hosts for today have been Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson, and Local Talk was engineered by Richard Morrison.
And you can also listen to the show on all our local past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Now remember, that's khoifm.org, and you'll find there an archive of all the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. And there you will find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio program. So if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KJOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.